Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Of the 9th Annual Sunstone Symposium, my name's Daniel Rector, and I hope you're enjoying yourself at the symposium this year. Thank you. That applause is for Lynn Whitesides. Lynn is the one that pulled this together. We'll have all of our acknowledgments and thank yous and that sort of thing later on tonight. But I appreciate that. Our speaker this morning is Mike Iaconelli. It was a strange occurrence for me to come to work at Sunstone year and a half ago and find there the magazine that has provided the greatest, some of the greatest theological insights and some of the most enjoyment that I've ever experienced. My favorite magazine I found it at Sunstone, but it wasn't Sunstone. It was called The Wittenberg Door. And I, at that time, decided that this was one person that we needed to bring out, the person who's responsible for this publication. Mike is the publisher of The Wittenberg Door, which is a Christian satire magazine. It's the mad magazine of Christian fundamentalism, I guess is the way you could describe it. And Mike was kicked out of Bob Jones University, and then subsequently he was kicked out of Bible Institute of Los Angeles. He is co-author of a very popular book entitled 101 Things to Do During a Dull Sermon. And I'm sure if we could have that in the book room or some flyers or something, I think there'd be some use for that for this group. Mike is the president of Youth Specialties. He holds several conferences each year and publishes materials to help those who are involved in youth outreach ministries, mostly among the evangelical Christian community. Mike is a non-Mormon, but says that some of his best friends are Mormons. He's the father of five and claims to be committed to populating at least five planets. So here's Mike Iaconelli.
Well, thanks. It's great to be in Mormon land. And I have been looking all over for the temple, but I haven't found it yet. That's because I came in late at night, and they immediately took me and got some food. And then I had to, I had some coffee, and then everybody left. So I'm, you know, a really interesting thing. In the Protestant church, we have a little thing in some of the churches. It's called a children's sermon. Every once in a while, they decide to bring all the little kids up front, and they have this little children's sermon. Before I get to that little part of my story, I have to remind you that, you know, in education for years in the church, we have believed that the best way to educate our little kids is to tell them a story, a little children's story, give them some kind of a little illustration, a little object lesson, and then real quickly, while you've got their attention, sort of slip in the sort of profound abstract truth that we want them to understand. So, for example, we have something like Gary the Gospel Glove. You take a little glove out, and you wave the little glove around. You say, now, boys and girls, what's this? And they go, it's a glove. And you go, okay, now, what is this glove? I want to show you, this is the most amazing glove you've ever seen. Look, it can hit me on the head. Of course, the glove doesn't move. Look, the glove can pick up this chair. It doesn't pick up the chair. You say, this glove can do a million things. There's something wrong. It's not doing it. And the little kids go, you put your hand inside the glove. You go, very good, boys and girls. And then you go, you know, there's a verse in Philippians that says, I can do all things through Christ who strengtheneth me. And we're just like that. We just are sort of gloves, and Christ gets inside of us and moves on around. The kids are all going, whoa, like that. You know, and everybody's going, this is unbelievable. And when they leave, you say to the little kid, what did you learn today? And the kid says, Jesus wore gloves. But the adults in the place are walking out going, whoa. That's the first time I've ever understood that verse. There's a good reason for that. That's because little kids can't think metaphorically. They can't think abstract like that. So they have no idea what you're talking about. Finally, when we get to be adults and we can understand them, they don't tell them to us anymore. Well, that's my talk for today. Thanks a lot for coming. A friend of mine was doing his little children's first children's sermon to little kids, and he did the typical deal where you kind of ask the little kids questions, and the questions get a little bit easier, and then they finally guess what the answer is. So he had them all up there, all these little kids sitting around. He said, okay, boys and girls, now I'm going to ask you some questions, and when you think you know the answer, you let me know. He says, okay, what has thick, gray, bushy hair and four legs? They just sit there. So finally, the guy gets a little nervous. You know, hey, seminary, this was supposed to work. He goes, okay, let me give you another question. What has four legs, gray, thick, bushy hair, a big, bushy tail, it runs up and down trees? Nothing. Some of you are going, I know. So finally, he said, okay, this is getting desperate. He finally had to think of one more thing. He said, okay. He said, one more question. He said, it has four legs, thick, gray, bushy hair, big, bushy tail, runs up and down trees, gathers nuts and hides them. Finally, a little kid in the back raises his hand. He goes, Johnny. He goes, well, he says, I know the answer is supposed to be Jesus, but it sounds like a squirrel to me. Isn't that a lot of the problem that we face in the church today? We got a whole group of people who are trying to come up with the right answer, what they think the church wants them to say, instead of what they really believe, what they really think is the right answer. They're so frightened and afraid, and that is why we have satire. That is why those of us who are satirists see the role of a satirist to try to help people deal with that dilemma that we face in any institution, but especially in the church. I'd like to start today by talking a little bit about what satire is. And I don't know whether this is true in the Mormon church or not, but we have a big thing about spiritual gifts. There's a whole bunch of gifts listed in the Bible, in Ephesians and Corinthians, have to do with spiritual gifts. It's always been amazing to me that the only people who really are into that are people who think they have the gift of teaching. I don't meet many people that have the gift of cleaning house. You know, that somehow they didn't get that gift. They got teaching. But I've always wondered what my spiritual gift is, and I've looked over that list, and I couldn't find it in Corinthians. I couldn't find it anywhere until I heard a statement by Ernest Hemingway, who was asked, what makes a great writer? He said, it's somebody with a built-in crap detector. And I suddenly discovered my spiritual gift. I also discovered why I couldn't find it in Ephesians. But I think that's what good satire is. It's just crap detecting. It's just kind of looking at something and going, you got to be kidding me. This can't be true. They don't really believe this. They're not really sitting there going along with this, are they? And that really is what the role of the satirist is all about. Bishop Stephen Neal, I have no idea what he was bishop of, but it sounds really good, once said, criticism is the manure in which the servants of the Lord grow best. I've had a lot of people suggest just that about us. But satire is not an argument. It is a mirror. You don't try to argue with satire. You simply try to make a point to hope that people will see what the problem is, to look at themselves and to look at others. Good satire militates against what people do, not the person themselves. That is, I think, really good, strong satire always goes after what the person is doing, but they don't go after the person. It's just like Jim and Tammy Faye Baker. They're real easy targets. They're real easy to make fun of. But I don't want to make fun of them. I want to make fun of what they're doing, because it's what they're doing that worries me. That's the thing that worries me. They I can love. They I can even forgive. But what they're doing is another issue. And that's what we must strive to deal with. And then, fifthly, effective satire must come, I think, must come from within, not from without. Because those who criticize effectively must also love what it is they criticize. You know, this is a great group of folk. Because you're Mormons. And yet, there are a lot of things about the Mormon church you're unhappy with. And because of that, so many of you in this place have been told or criticized because they say to you, you're not really a Mormon. You're not really part of the church. You're on the fringe. You're a troublemaker. You're disruptive. There's something wrong with you. And deep in your heart, you're going, what are you talking about? I love this church. I love these people. That's why I'm criticizing it. I have the right to, because I'm part of it. It's me that I'm criticizing. I'm criticizing what's going on. I'm not standing outside looking in. I'm inside looking in and saying, hey, there's some things here we've got to deal with. And that's the toughest role of all, because you're sitting in churches and in meetings and all that kind of thing, and you're walking out of the meeting going, what? And all your friends are going, wasn't that wonderful? You know, there are a number of little elements of satire that I want to look at for just a second. The first is that the ability to laugh. And some of us just naturally, instead of crying when we see something bad, we laugh. We make fun of it. I mean, some people cry and weep about it. We don't. We laugh about it. And it's not really laughter, is it? It's really crying inside, but we have the only way we know how to express it is by sort of making fun of it. It hurts so much that we figure if we laugh about it, maybe that'll make it okay. In our magazine, we gave an award away, we do every so often, called the Theologian of the Year. And a few years ago, Tammy Faye Baker was our Theologian of the Year. Now, all we did was take a book that she had sold 60,000 copies of. And we excerpt a little bit from that book. Didn't say anything else. And when people read it, they had no choice. I want to read it to you. It's in a book called I Gotta Be Me, which I think is an incredibly profound... And in this book, she deals with the difficult theological issues of our day, death, grief, God's healing, God's will, all in one remarkable story of Chi-Chi the dog. One day while eating supper, little Chi-Chi, who liked lima beans, ate some and ran into another room. My kids do the same thing. I had noticed that Chi-Chi had been losing weight and couldn't understand why. When the dog didn't return, I wondered. Jim had seen the dog fall over on the carpet and not get up. Jim went and checked Chi-Chi and then gently said, Tammy, Chi-Chi is dead. I thought my world had come to an end because this was the first time death had ever entered into me. I had never seen anyone die that I loved so much. I wanted to run out in the street and scream. I wasn't thinking about God, only about the fact that Chi-Chi was dead. I couldn't stop crying. And then I began to fall apart. At that very moment, a real estate man wanted to show our house to someone. Now, this is the scene I want you to picture. Jim handed Chi-Chi to him and said, would you keep Chi-Chi for a couple of days? He's dead. Jim put his arms around me and I cried and cried. I said, Jim, have them keep Chi-Chi for a couple of days. Please don't let them bury him right away because I know God can raise things from the dead. Please don't let them bury Chi-Chi. I prayed and prayed and prayed. Oh, Jesus, please raise Chi-Chi from the dead. I expected Jim to bring Chi-Chi home at any minute. I knew God could do it and Chi-Chi would be all right. I expected to open the door and there would be Chi-Chi as usual. The fact was that Chi-Chi was a naughty little dog. I loved him so much, but several times I'd wanted to give him away because he'd wet on our drapes. especially when he'd get mad at us. But you see, God knew how to take care of Chi-Chi. God knew that if he took him, then that would be the end of wedding all over the room. And I'm telling you, her kids were house trained at about 1 month. Well, now, I read that to you. It breaks my heart to realize that Jim and Tammy had no idea what they were writing. They had no idea how ridiculous that sounded. And there were 60,000 people that bought that book that never once wrote in and said, "What?" Now, I mean, that tends to bother you a little bit. The second part of satire is outrage. The first part we laugh, but there's a part of us who are satirists that do get upset, and we do get angry, and we do get outraged. There are some things that the church does, that the institution does, that make us angry. We wish we didn't get angry, but we can't help it. You know why we can't help it? Because we should get angry. Because we have every right to get angry. Because what is happening is absolutely contradictory to everything we believe in. And that we have to somehow speak out. If we didn't, the stones would speak out. Honestly, there are certain things that are true and right, and somebody gets angry about them because they are true and they are right, and we have to defend them. I'm thinking about something that's going on right now in the Protestant church. You know, we have this little thing called tithing. You give 10% of your money, and a lot of churches are coming up with all these interesting little tithing programs. And this is not a little program, by the way. This is sweeping the country, and there are thousands of huge churches of 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 members that have instituted this new kind of tithing program. It's called God's Guarantee Plan. Now, here's how it works. You get a little pledge card at the beginning of the year. It says, "I will give 10% of my money to the church for the next 90 days. Second part of the deal. If at the end of the 90 days you're not completely satisfied with the results, the church will give you the money back." Now, you know what I don't understand? I don't understand that when the pastor, in his great sort of pastoral tones, said this, I can't imagine inside of me why the entire congregation didn't stand up and go, "What? Are you nuts? I don't ever remember Jesus saying, 'Take up your cross and follow me, and at the end of 90 days, you're not completely satisfied.'" You have to get mad at stuff like that. Well, I could spend the entire time we have sitting around philosophizing and intellectualizing about what satire is and isn't. But you know what? The problem is so much deeper than that. We don't need any more philosophy and intellectualizing about it. The reason we have satirists, and the reason that we talk about satire is because the world out here is going to hell on a roller skate. People are struggling and lonely and looking for something that will give their life meaning and significance. And the church is running around talking and philosophizing, intellectualizing, when in fact people have desperate needs that need to be met. That's what we're here for. That's why we care about this thing. Because we care about people and the needs and the loneliness and the desperation that goes on in our culture today. You know, I used to pastor a church for 6 years. And after hearing me today, you probably know why they asked me to think of something else to do. But I can remember one time we were going to have a church picnic, and one of the people in our church who had never been to church before, just started coming to our church, had a great idea. They said, "Why don't we do this around a Hawaiian theme, and we'll have Polynesian dancers? I happen to know two or three women that do Polynesian dancing, and it'd be incredible. What do you think?" This woman had never offered to help do anything in our church, and so I said, "That sounds great. Terrific." And then I went to our board, and I said, "We're going to have a picnic, and we're going to have Polynesian dancing." And they all went, "Polynesian dancing? You mean where they kind of..." "Yeah. I don't really think that would be appropriate at a church event." We had this gigantic argument over Polynesian dancing. This went on for about an hour or 2 hours. Finally, I totally lost my cool. And I looked at these guys and I said, okay, fine. We won't have Polynesian dancing. I hadn't really thought about it, but you know, I've been in youth work now 25 years. I've seen kids on drugs. I've seen them on dope. I've seen them on all that kind of thing. And you know, now that I think of it, I can remember them all sitting down with me and saying, it all began with Polynesian dancing. I was doing great, and then I saw a Polynesian dancer. I mean, it just blew me away. I thought to myself, what is the matter with you? Surely you can't believe that this is an issue, that this really does matter today. I recently spoke at a Nazarene college. Nazarenes do not believe in drinking, dancing, smoking, going to movies, that kind of thing. And my first statement to the college, I haven't been invited back since, was, you know, a lot of people think that Christianity has to do with we don't drink, we don't smoke, we don't chew, and we don't go with girls that do. We don't go to movies, and I'm here to tell you that nobody cares. That in the real world out there, nobody gives a rip whether you go to movies or not. Nobody gives a rip whether you smoke or not. Nobody gives a rip whether you dance or not. What they care about has so much to do, so much deeper than that. What they want to know is, do you love me? Will you listen to me? Do you care about me? That's what matters in this world today. And that other stuff doesn't make any difference. Well, needless to say, that didn't go over real well with the administration. The kids gave me a standing ovation. The administration made a rule that I couldn't speak there anymore. I guess what I'd like to do for just a few minutes is to say to you then, why is it that we have satirists? And what is it that we believe really does matter in this culture? That is, I have my guesses that most of you in this room are upset with certain things in the church, not because you want to make your point and show how smart you are, but because what you're trying to do is to say to the church, would you please listen to the real world out there? Would you get out of your ivory tower, go out there where people really live, and hear what it is they are struggling with and dealing with, and then understand that. And take all your structures and all that stuff and say, we'll forget all that right now. Let's see if we can try to communicate to this world the people we're living with. I want to deal with what I think people need to hear today. You may agree or disagree. My feeling has always been, if you agree with everything I've said, one of us isn't necessary. The first issue I think we need to address today is that too many people today are taking life too seriously. I mean, do you realize the amount of stress that is being put on our kids as they're growing up nowadays? Remember, you know, there was a book written back in the 60s called Is There Life After High School? I mean, do you remember when high school was fun? Do you remember when going to school was a blast? You didn't want to leave high school. You never wanted to get out of it. Now these kids are under so much pressure, they're even in junior high school taking pre-SAT tests. They're taking college prep courses in 7th and 8th and 9th and 10th grade. They're looking like little miniature adults. I mean, have you noticed? 9-year-old kids running around with giant earrings, pantyhose, bras, makeup, lip gloss. And then there's the girls. It's unbelievable. Kids don't know how to play anymore. I mean, my gosh, in some large cities, you have to go out and line up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning to get your kid on the list for the soccer team. For a particular position on the soccer team. Not, he can't play. I mean, the idea of playing anymore has disappeared. And so many adults are so serious all the time. We're so uptight and serious. And then, of course, you add to that the church and religion and God and Jesus and spiritual stuff. And now it's almost like it's this incredible burden. I mean, have you ever been in church when someone burped? And everybody sort of, they're, you know, almost blows out their sinuses because you're all sitting there. I mean, wouldn't it be great if the pastor could just go, okay, who did it? I mean, what is wrong with admitting that? That was funny. I can remember growing up in a very, very conservative church, and we would love to ask our Sunday school teacher tough questions that would just, you know, kind of embarrass him and nail him. And I can remember we'd say, you know, what does the Bible say about French kissing? You know, the teacher would go, well, we don't live in France, so I don't understand, you know. And our teacher would sort of stumble around for a while, and then she would finally look at us and she would say the statement that wiped out all of us. She would go, Mike, I can't really find a specific verse, but I can tell you this. All you have to do when you're in a dilemma like that is ask yourself the question, if Jesus were there, would you do it? I was constipated for 3 days. I kept on kissing, but no way was I going to the bathroom. I mean, the attitude was sort of like, you know, if Jesus were here, nobody laughs. Nobody does nothing. We all just kind of sit around like this. That's malarkey. I think one of the ways we communicate the reality of our faith to this world is we know how to laugh. We know how to have joy. We know how to play. One of the reasons your kids think being an adult is such a drag is they've never seen you laugh. They've never seen you had a good time. I mean, that's one thing that the Mormons have always emphasized, the strength of the family. And one of the things that I think that we need to reemphasize is playing together as a family. Having a good time. No wonder kids don't think adult. They think they're all boring and too serious and that kind of thing. I mean, when's the last time you had adults and kids playing together? You know, adults are always just want to sit around and talk. That's a lot of fun. We put out books of games, and one of the games in one of our books is called The Polaroid Scavenger Hunt. And that is really a kick. And the deal is that you get a group of, you know, a car, everybody has a car, and we have adults drive, and the theory being that adults will be much safer in their driving than the kids. And then you have the kids in the car, and they get a list of pictures they have to take, and they have about 2.5 hours to go around and take as many pictures as they can, and they get points for them, okay? So, for example, all the kids in the car in a phone booth, that's 100 points. All the kids in the car at somebody's house they don't know having dinner. So they have to go up to somebody's house. Are you folks having dinner yet? Do you mind if we come in a minute? Okay, great. Bye-bye. Well, one group I know, a youth group, had put this thing on, and they ran out of adult drivers. And so they didn't know what to do, and they finally started thinking around, and somebody said, what about Mrs. Johnson? And they all went, oh, yippee. Mrs. Johnson's the most boring woman in the universe. She has 4 kids. She's overweight. She just sits in the back of the church taking care of her kids. That's all she ever does. We don't want Mrs. Johnson. Well, you're getting her. So they go, okay, great. So the group of kids that got Mrs. Johnson were just really thrilled. They get their list. Everybody runs out into the cars. The kids all run into the cars, and Miss Johnson sit down, and she's sitting there like this. Her eyes are kind of in a glaze. Because what the kids don't know is that Mrs. Johnson is remembering back to when she was in college. She was in a sorority. She was a cheerleader. She married the quarterback on the football team. She was a party animal. She'd forgotten all about it. And as she sits in that car, she remembers, puts the car in gear, like that, the kids are all going out. She drives like a maniac. She runs up the house. You having dinner? Good. Kids, get in there. Bam, bam. She's driving down the freeway 70 miles an hour. A cop pulls him over. She says, kids, stay here. She jumps out of the car and runs back. And on the list was 2 of the kids in the back of a police car. She goes, I can't believe it. Thank you for stopping. Kids, back. Bam. I'm telling you, when those kids got out of jail, they remembered. You want to know what happened? Mrs. Johnson became a legend. She became a hero. These kids did not know adults could be so much fun. They had no idea you could enjoy life that much. And I honestly believe we got booze and drugs and all this electronic and technological junk and everything else going around us. I'm telling you, we have lost the ability to just have fun together and to laugh and to enjoy life. And I think that is joy. We always say, you know, happiness is when you giggle and laugh. But joy, even in the midst of sorrow.
you know.
So it's like, you know, don't go laughing, because that's not real. What's real is joy in the midst of sorrow.
This is the end of side one.
That's okay, and I think our world needs to hear more of that. I think our world needs to see that in the church, in the institution. We don't, to be quite honest with you, it simply means we don't take ourselves too seriously. And that is the most dangerous and risky thing of all, and that is the purpose of satire. It's always to kind of slip in a little pin that pops that balloon. I've met a lot of so-called important people in our magazine life as we've interviewed different people, and let me tell you, most of them are a bunch of pompous, egotistic maniacs. And I'm trying to be kind, but that's what they are. And they need their balloon pop, but they have all these people around them who are trying to protect them. They're all yes people, and they're trying to protect everybody from getting to them. And those people are very, very destructive. Nobody needs to be protected from anybody. You and I don't have people running around protecting everybody from us. Maybe we should, but we don't. The second thing I think we need to say to this world today is the issue of self-worth. I think, frankly, there is a crisis in self-worth today. People have no idea what they want to be, where they want to go, what they want to do. 70 or 80% of the workforce is unhappy in the jobs they have. And so many of our kids are going to high school, they're going to 4 years of college, getting their master's, getting their doctorate. They still don't know what they want to be. They end up selling Amway. Why go to all that college? Just start selling Amway. You could be at the diamond level by the time you could have had your doctorate. I'm serious. People are desperate today. And you know, part of the reason is we're taking kids and we're jamming them through school, getting them through high school, immediately putting them into college, keeping them in college all their lives. You know what I'm telling high school kids? When they graduate from high school, take a year off. See the world a little bit. That's one thing the Mormons are doing right. They're sending their kids off in missions for 2 years. What an incredible thing. These kids see the world. They see poverty. They see how the other part of the world lives. And suddenly, now, God can make a call in their lives. We've forgotten the whole idea of the sense of call. It's about time that we rediscover the call of God. That little voice of God. I happen to live in a town called Wairika. Wairika has 3,000 people. It's redneck city of the universe. We have one police station that runs the entire town, and we have one high school and one traffic light. And I tell you, I don't know what in the world I'm doing there, except that God has called me to be there. And that's okay. It's suddenly, I love it. I like the town. I love what's there because God has called me there. I think the sense of call is something that all of us in this room need to rehear again. We need to help our people rediscover this. There's so many people who don't feel worthy, who feel like they don't have anything to offer. And you know why that is? It's because the church keeps telling us, you gotta work. And the more you work, the better off you are. By the way, I'm not talking about Mormon church. I'm talking about Protestant church. They say they're for grace, but they mean after you work. Work, work, work. You go out and do for God. You've got to give 30 minutes a day in Bible reading, 30 minutes a day in prayer, and all kind of thing. And most of us in this room, if we're really honest, we don't do that. And we are so disappointed with ourselves and feel so bad about what we're not doing that we never sit around and celebrate what we are doing. Because I have the feeling that most of, you know, I have to tell you how I feel about what goes on here. Let's suppose that I don't pray. And I go to a meeting like this and the guy says, I pray 30 minutes a day. I love it when people do that. Makes you feel totally guilty. You go running out of there and going, okay, I'm going to start praying 30 minutes a day. I make my list. I get down the next day. Stopwatch is going. I start. I pray my mom, my dad, my brothers, my sisters, my uncles, my aunts, all my friends, all my enemies, the missionaries of the world, everything's going on in the world. I get all done. 2 minutes. Now, what do you think's going on in heaven? Here's what I think's going on in heaven. God's up there going, hold it! Listen to this! Yaconelli just came through with 2 minutes! Woohoo! All right, yeah! Now I don't pray the rest of the week. I get busy. Next week I go, oh, prayer time, I forgot. I pray again. This time it's 4 minutes. What do you think's going on in heaven? God's up there going, unbelievable. He doubled his time. All right, bring out the pizza. I mean, they're going crazy. You know, we get so wrapped up in what we don't do, and so many of us are so oppressed by what we're not doing, that we don't look at what it is we are doing. 2 minutes a week, that's incredible. 4 minutes a week, that's unbelievable. That's 4 minutes more than 99.9% of the rest of the people. The fact of the matter is that there are a lot of us doing a lot for God, and I have a little philosophy about that. It's a little sentence that goes like this. Something is better than nothing. That's the way I live my life. I really, really think that's valuable and important, and people need to hear that. That whatever they do is making a difference. It's somehow making a significant, meaningful difference in the world. The trouble is that the church wants to take what we do and organize it and structure it and make it so that there are only certain things that really count. Oh, you're chairman of the committee. Good. God's really impressed. God's up there going, yeah, Kenelly, just made chairman. Nice job. All right, yeah. You know, little things that we do or anything that we do somehow doesn't count. It all has to be categorized and put in little systems so that we can decide where we really count. That's malarkey. Because I'm here to tell you that very often it's the things that we don't think we're doing that make any difference that really make the difference. How many times I remember going to meetings and hearing people say, we have family devotions every night. I'm going, sheesh. I do not do family devotions with my kids, so tonight we're going to do it. I walk into my two boys and I go, guys, we're having devotions. And they're going, hey, great, we're thrilled. Can we listen to our Walkman? No. Okay, we're going to talk about God. I read a little portion of Scripture. Okay, what do you think about that? I don't know. All of a sudden, by the end of the evening, we're having a giant fight. Look, guys, I said we're going to have devotions. You're not talking. Now start talking. We're going to enjoy this. You need it, and I need it. I walk out of the room. That's it. We're not having devotions anymore. They're going, oh, no. Three days later, I'm under my car trying to fix the transmission. My oldest teenage son slides under the car next to me and he goes, hey, Dad, what's God like? I'm going, where did this come from? Why all of a sudden does my kid want to talk about God? I don't know. It ain't in Sunday school. It's not the way it's supposed to be. But boy, you better drop everything. Not the transmission. But you better drop everything else and begin to listen to that kid and focus on what he's saying. Because for some reason, he's ready now to learn. He's ready to hear about what God has to say. And I have the feeling that so many of us in this room are so oppressed by trying to do religious things, trying to figure out how we calculate so that we can really impress people with how godly we are, instead of just falling in love with God and letting the consequences fall where they may. I have a good friend of mine who is a Catholic priest. And he tells the story. He's also an alcoholic. And he became an alcoholic and ended up in the gutters of Fort Lauderdale in 1976. And a young man, he finally called, he was having the DTs, and he was able to call an operator and say, send somebody from AA over. And the man who showed up was a man who had been an alcoholic all of his life almost. The man had no money, had not had a job, he'd lost his family. He came over, found Brennan, this priest, on the floor, took him to the hospital, stayed up with him all night for 7 days and nights, would sleep by him, talk with him, try to help him through, work this thing through. The man did not believe in God, but he sat there telling Brennan how important it was that he keep his faith in God and all that kind of thing. At the end of the 7 days, he was finally free enough to get out of the hospital, and this man took him to buy his first meal, even though he had very little money. He took him to McDonald's, and they bought a meal together. And this man nursed this priest back to health again. About 2 years later, this priest friend of mine was in the city where he had been an alcoholic, and he wanted to go see his friend, and he went to AA, and they said, well, he's become an alcoholic again. I mean, he was always an alcoholic, but he's back on the bottle again. He'd OD'd. He tried to help so many people, he'd burnt out. And so Brennan decided to go down and find him, to go down to Skid Row and see if he could find his friend. And the result was that he went down there looking all over the place to find him. And I have a little quote from his book, and I want to read it for you. As I drove through Skid Row, I spotted a man in a doorway who I thought was my friend. He wasn't. Just another drunk wino who was neither sober nor drunk. Just dry. He hadn't had a drink in 24 hours, and his hands trembled violently. He reached out and asked, "Hey man, can you give me a dollar to get some wine?" I knelt down before him and took his hands in mine. I looked into his eyes. They filled with tears. I leaned over and kissed his hands. He began to cry. He didn't want a dollar. He wanted what I wanted 2 years earlier, lying on the motel floor, to be accepted in his brokenness, to be affirmed in his worthlessness, to be loved in his loneliness. I never located my friend. Several days later, I was celebrating Eucharist for a group of recovering alcoholics. Midway through the homily, my friend walked through the door. My heart skipped, but he disappeared during the distribution of communion and did not return. 2 days later, I received a letter from him, which reads in part, "Two nights ago, in my own clumsy way, I prayed for the right to belong, just to belong with you at Mass. You will never know what you did for me last week on Skid Row. You didn't see me, but I saw you. I was standing a few feet away in a storefront window when I saw you kneel down and kiss that wino's hands. You wiped away from my eyes the blank stare of the breathing dead. When I saw you really cared, my heart began to grow wings, small wings, feeble wings, but wings. I threw my bottle of Gallo wine down the sewer. Your tenderness and understanding breathed life into me, and I want you to know that." Here Brennan was kissing the hands of another man, and another person's life was totally changed. We have no idea what God is doing in our lives, and we need to quit oppressing people with what they're not doing and encourage them with what they are. One last point, and I promise you I'm done, and that's fear. Have you noticed that people are afraid? They're scared to death of God. It's not just they're afraid of AIDS. They're not afraid of nuclear war. There's this deep sense of fear in all of us that it's not AIDS, it's not nuclear war, it's not all this other stuff. It's that something is desperately wrong with the whole thing. It's like we all have this deep down fear that the whole ground beneath us is going to crumble, like something is wrong. And then we try to say to people, "Well, you need to come to God. You need to know what Christ's love is like. You need to respond to the gospel." And we see people backing off and saying, "Hold it right there, no way." We're scared to death. People are afraid of God. Isn't that odd? I mean, that's part of our trouble, is that we're trying to communicate to people the love of a God that they're afraid of. Well, I'm here to tell you that the message of the church needs to be not, "You're only acceptable if you do this, this, and this." The message of the church needs to be, God loves you. The doors are open. He loves you with everything. You have nothing to be afraid of. I play hide and seek with my kids. I used to. They're much older now, so we don't play it too much because they win. And my two boys were real young, 3 and 5 years old. I can remember playing hide and seek with them, and I added a little dimension. I don't know whether you folks do this or not. I added the dimension in our game of total fear. When my kids would catch me, when they would find out where I was hidden, I would scare the heck out of them to try to make them pay for finding me. And I can remember one time I went and hid in the bedroom. My two little boys were holding hands together. They knew exactly what the deal was all about. They knew I was going to scare them. They knew that was part of the game. They were holding hands. Their eyes were about this big around. And they were kind of walking carefully into the kitchen. And they went, "He's in the cupboard." So they both go, you look. "No, you look. Okay, we'll both look." They went over to the cupboard. They grabbed the door. They pulled the door open. I wasn't in there. And then I did what every parent does when that moment happens. I went, "Ah!" The oldest son goes, "He's not in the cupboard. He's in the bedroom." They both walk into the bedroom. Now, this is interesting. It's dark in the bedroom. The door's kind of open. I'm hiding behind the door. The light switch is right there. They can turn it on, but they don't. They're both holding hands. They're walking in very carefully. They know I'm behind that door. They sort of reach their heads around. And just as I see the tip of the oldest boy head coming around the door, I leap out from behind the door and I go, "Rah!" And when I do that, they both go, "Ah!" And they're running to each other. They're tripping all over each other. And I can see them kind of looking at me, looking back at each other. And suddenly they both look at each other and they go, "What the heck are we doing? We don't need to be afraid. This is our dad. Attack!" And they do. Isn't that the mission of the church? We're going to people and saying, "What the heck are you doing? You don't have to be afraid. This is your papa. This is your daddy. That's what it means in Romans when it says we have the spirit of adoption whereby we cry, Abba, Papa, Daddy. That's his. We're the apple of his eye. He loves us with everything. And when we communicate to that to this world, they no longer are afraid of God. They embrace him. They throw their arms around him and say, oh, thank you for the good news. And lastly, I said lastly last time, but now I really mean it. People today need to believe that they're loved. They just don't believe they're loved. And you know, just a couple of little hints here. I know I'm supposed to talk about satire, but let me just nail a couple of things down. You know why people don't think they're loved? Number one, nobody listens to us anymore. Everybody's running around preaching. Aren't you sick of it? I'm sick of TV specials. I'm sick of cassettes. I'm sick of seminars. I'm sick of everything where people are running around. 8 ways to overcome depression. 9 ways to have a happy marriage. 6 ways to know the will of God. 4 ways. I mean, they didn't read the New Testament, did they? Jesus would get up there and say, blessed are the poor. And when he'd get done, they'd go, huh? And he'd go, well, let me explain what I mean. One time there was a guy and the rains came and he built his house on the sand. He gets all done and they go, what? He goes, good night, guys. I'll see you. What the heck was that? He didn't explain anything. He just left them there, hanging, struggling with the thing. And I honestly think that people today are sick and tired of sermons. They just would like somebody to shut up long enough to listen to them. I got a good friend of mine who died. 3 of his kids died of cancer. When the 3rd boy died of cancer, he said all these people came into the hospital room, tapes and books and advice and prayers. He said I could hardly wait for him to get out of the room. Then he says a friend of mine walked in and lost his own kid in a tragic car accident, grabbed a chair, slid it up next to me, reached out and held my hand, never said a word. He says, I never wanted the man to leave. You know, I happen to think that the Mormon church would triple its evangelistic effort if it shut up long enough to listen to people. Forget the doctrine. Forget all the rest. Can you imagine 2 guys riding up on their bike to your front door? Knock, knock, knock. Yes, hello. Hi, we just wanted to come in and listen. No books, no tapes, no slide projector? No. We just want to listen to you. We just want to hear what it is you're hearing. You know, Jesus said a very interesting thing. He said, when people weep, you weep with them. When they laugh, you laugh with them. You know, now when people get depressed, we go, hey, listen to this tape. Doesn't that make you mad when you're depressed and people come up to you and go, what's the matter? I'm depressed. Hey, don't be depressed. It's like you're stupid. You know, it's like, oh, I forgot. I didn't think, okay, great. Hey, no problem. The Bible says if you really want to help people who are depressed, get depressed with them. When they weep, you weep. And when they laugh, you laugh. Not give them a sermon, not give them a tape, not give them 8 ways to overcome that. You just listen and care and empathize with them. The second thing is affirmation. Gosh, nobody affirms anybody anymore. When's the last time your husband said to you in a little note, honey, you are so neat. You are so special. I am so lucky. When's the last time you said to your husband, you know, you work your tail off and I'm always yelling at you, I'm doing this or that. Sometimes at least you accuse me of that. I want you to know, I love you. You are so neat. And you know what? Kids today never hear affirmation from an adult. You know, I did a study of how I talked to my teenage kid in a day. It was unbelievable. I never said one positive thing the entire day. 7 o'clock in the morning, get up, get in there, take a shower, don't use all the hot water, hang up your towel where it belongs, get all your clothes cleaned up, don't leave anything in the closet, get up there, have a decent breakfast, no Cocoa Puffs, be out and ready to go at 7:45, and if you're not ready, I'm not taking you. He gets out there at 7:45. Did you hang up your towel? Yes. Did you clean up the bathroom? Yeah. Did you use the hot water? No. Did you have good breakfast? Yes. What time did you get home? 3:30. Okay. Stack the wood. Mow the lawn. Help your mom with dinner. I get home at 5:30. Did you get home at 3:30? Yeah. Did you stack the wood? Yeah. Mow the lawn? Yeah. Help your mom with dinner? Yeah. You have homework? Okay. No TV? Get in. My kid's going, wow, it's great to be around you, Dad. I felt so bad. The next morning I got up and fixed the most incredible Italian omelet you'd ever seen in your life. I mean, zucchini, the whole number. I got out our china. I got out our silverware. I got out the big, giant silver tray that we'd never used since our wedding. I got out all that unbelievable stuff. I took wine glasses, put them in the freezer till they got absolutely, you know how they get, you get them wet and put them in the freezer, and you take them out and they frost all up. I put orange juice in there, whipped cream on top, set everything up, went in and woke my boys up early. It was Saturday morning, about 11 o'clock, and I walked into the room. My guys kind of opened their eyes. I said, boys,
I just wanted to tell you, I love you guys. You are really neat. I not only love you, I like you. And I fixed you breakfast. And they both looked at each other, sat up in their bed, looked at me and said, what do you want us to do, Dad? They could not believe. There was no hook. They were so blown away that I would actually say something positive to them without some kind of hook coming in on the other side. You know, people are so desperate today for affirmation. For somebody to say, I like you. You are a nice person. I really enjoy you. I love this certain part about you and what you do. And the last part of love is still part of the last point. This is the last. You want to know how the church can really communicate to this world today in their love? They listen, they affirm, they're empathetic, they try to understand, and lastly and most importantly, they learn how to reach out to people and meet them where they are. Not where they're supposed to be, but where they are. I read a book called Mortal Lessons. It's a book written by a surgeon who I don't think even believes in God. But he wrote a story that I want to close with. It's my last illustration of the last point of the last section. Now think about this. You're about 25 years old. You're a beautiful young woman. And you've married the man of your dreams. Everything's just wonderful. You're going along for 2 years. Everything's great. You've sort of made a lot of assumptions about life. And suddenly you begin to notice something wrong in your face. And you go to the surgeon, and he notices the same thing, and they take x-rays, and they discover that you have a tumor on your face. And you're this beautiful young girl who the doctor says is now going to have to be operated on so that they can cut the tumor out. And then he says, it may very well be that because of where that tumor is located, I may have to cut some of the nerves in your face. And if I do that, for the rest of your life, your face will be distorted. The whole right side of your face will be distended and palsied, but I will save your life. So she faces that kind of surgery, and Dr. Seltzer tells us what happens after the surgery. I stand by the bed where a young woman lies, her face post-operative, her mouth twisted in palsy, clownish. A tiny twig of the facial nerve, the one to the muscles of her mouth, has been severed. She will be thus from now on. The surgeon had followed with religious fervor the curve of her flesh, I promise you that, but nevertheless, to remove the tumor in her cheek, I had to cut the little nerve. Her young husband is in the room. He stands on the opposite side of the bed, and together they seem to dwell in the evening lamplight, isolated from me, private. Who are they, I ask myself, he and this wry mouth I have made, who gaze at and touch each other so generously, greedily? The young woman speaks. Will my mouth always be like this? Yes, I say it will. It is because the nerve was cut. She nods and is silent. But the young man smiles. I like it, he says. It's kind of cute. All at once I know who he is. I understand and I lower my gaze. One is not bold in an encounter with a god. Unmindful, he bends to kiss her crooked mouth. And I am so close, I can see how he twists his own lips to accommodate to hers, to show her that their kiss still works. That is love. And let me tell you, when Jesus Christ twisted himself on the cross for you and me to tell us that we still work, that is the gospel. That is the good news. And that is the message we need to bring to this world. Thank you. God bless all of you.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for your attendance, and I hope you enjoy the rest of this day.
This is the end of this cassette.